we're optimistic that 2012 is going to work. And then, you know, we look for each, you know, each year after that.
Shell's Arctic drilling plans are back on the table. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a young woman from Nome is crowned the new Miss Indian World.
It took a whole community to teach me these cultural values that I have, and that's been instilled inside of me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Shell Alaska is asking the federal government to review a new set of plans for drilling in the Arctic. Shell Vice President for Alaska Pete Slaby says the company will seek to drill 10 exploratory wells over two seasons, starting in 2012. Even though Shell has been working to get an air permit for 5 years, Slaby says there are hopeful signs that things can now move forward.
We're certain, and I think the EPA is certain as well, is our air emissions will not be harmful for any of the communities in the area. And I think that's been borne out even under the most rigorous conditions. It's not a challenged airship per se, and we've put a lot of controls in place to make sure it stays unchallenged. So we feel better about that.
The company plans to file its plans with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, or BOEMER, on Wednesday. The plan calls for two drill rigs. One will drill two wells each year in the Beaufort Sea's Camden Bay area, and one will drill three wells per year in the Chukchi. The drilling plan is for 2012 and 13. Slaby says there are estimates as high as 25 to 27 billion barrels of oil and 127 trillion cubic feet of gas in offshore Arctic waters. Slaby says the prospects are why Shell has continued to pursue permitting.
We're optimistic that 2012 is going to work, and then, you know, we look for each, you know, each year after that. It's something that we really can't say right now that, you know, if 2012 wouldn't work, this would be it. I think clearly we have to go back and continue the dialogue with both the regulators and the government about this as an opportunity, and that's what this is.
Conservation groups have been critical of offshore plans in the Arctic, citing severe weather and a lack of proper emergency oil spill cleanup equipment in such remote locations. Alaska's congressional delegation is cheering the death of al-Qaeda leader and 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden, but they're warning of a need for vigilance against terrorists and asking tough questions about Pakistan. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Congressman Don Young was flying to D.C. when word broke of Osama bin Laden's death, so he was surprised by the news when he landed.
When I first heard it, I thought, okay, this is April Fool's Day. I'm serious. I don't always trust what I hear on the radio or TV or anything else. And, of course, in the morning I got a short briefing today, and, you know, it apparently is true.
Young says he thought it was likely bin Laden had actually been killed long ago, so he wants to see proof in photos.
I hope they got some good pictures so we can, I haven't seen them, but so we can truly verify that it was Osama bin Laden. I mean, but they already buried him at sea, which always strikes me as a little interesting.
Young says this hammers home questions he already has about the mission in Afghanistan and brings up concerns about how reliable Pakistan is.
I can't speak whether we can trust them. I don't really trust a whole lot of people that are basically not friendly with us, and that goes for the Middle East in total.
Senator Lisa Murkowski used to sit on the Foreign Relations Committee and points out that the U.S. is paying Pakistan more than $1 billion a year for counterterrorism efforts. She has questions about whether the country's leadership has been acting in good faith. The senior Republican senator says the morning after view is throwing into new light that relationship.
What we see being discussed now is, I think, Americans feeling like perhaps Pakistan duped them a little bit on this. The fact that we found bin Laden not in the wild lands of Waziristan, but in a city of a half a million in an area that was right next to a military academy, a pretty impressive-looking compound that, for all intents and purposes, appeared was built for him. It causes one to wonder how complicit Pakistan was, how much they knew.
Murkowski says killing bin Laden has taken down a figurehead. She and the rest of the delegation say this sends a message that the U.S. will hunt down and find those who attack it. The delegation is also united in its praise for the service members and intelligence officers that led to bin Laden's hideout and carried out the attack. However, only Senator Mark Begich took time to praise President Obama's leadership. He also gave kudos to former President George W. Bush, but said Obama deserves credit for making what he says were tough final calls. Begich says the war in Afghanistan has never been about just bin Laden, but he says the leader was an important symbol to al-Qaeda.
Taking him out really sends a message to those fighters that, you know, we've taken the head of the horse off, and now it's the rest of them. And I think that creates disruption and creates an opportunity for us to continue to do what we need to do in Afghanistan and get it more stable. But at the same time, there's a lot of other work.
All three delegation members warn of a need for constant vigilance.
With or without bin Laden, they will continue to attack us whatever they can. So we have to keep that in mind. That's not going away in the sense of, geez, now bin Laden's gone, now everything's just, the world is at peace. We wish, we hope, but that's not the reality because there are people out there who are radicals and have one interest in mind, and that is to, you know, destroy the United States any way they can.
As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Begich expects briefings in the coming weeks about a host of issues surrounding the attack on bin Laden's compound and the what next questions the delegation is asking. Senator Murkowski is attending a dinner at the White House tonight for committee heads planned before this news broke. Murkowski says she expects the conversation to turn to the big topic, the end of the decade-long hunt for Osama bin Laden. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
While state lawmakers squabble over Alaska's capital budget, Matanuska Susitna taxpayers are being presented with a proposed $378.9 million comprehensive budget by Matanuska Susitna Borough officials. The borough's fiscal year 2012 spending plan includes $259.5 million for school district operations, $43 million for borough operations, and $19 million for capital projects. The bulk of the budget will pay for school costs to keep pace with the fast-growing population of the Mat-Su. Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan.
The school population has been rising. We grew 50% in one decade, the whole borough. So we do have to look at growth.
Public hearings on the borough budget are set to begin this week, with the first meeting scheduled for May 4th and 5th in Wasilla. Acting borough manager Elizabeth Gray authored the proposed budget. Gray said during an overview of the plan last week that it was aimed to maintain services while minimizing the effects of the borough's mill levy. The borough assembly is expected to make amendments to the budget in the coming weeks before final approval of the plan. Nome's Marjorie Tabone was crowned Miss Indian World on Saturday evening at the Gathering of Nations powwow in Albuquerque, New Mexico. A student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Tabone competed against 24 indigenous women from throughout North America. From Nome, KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
At the Miss Indian World competition, Marjorie Tabone represented not only Nome, but Alaska Natives from throughout the state. Being crowned Miss Eskimo Indian Olympics last year in Fairbanks, she continued to the Gathering of Nations powwow to further share more of her culture, the Inupiaq culture, to people throughout North America. Tabone says she could not have attended the powwow without the support of her community. She also says she is who she is today, thanks to many.
It took a whole community to teach me these cultural values that I have, and that's been instilled inside of me. And it's hard to pick just one person, but, you know, my backbone, my supporter would have to be my parents and my mother, because she's so supportive of what I've done, and she doesn't tell me things that I have to do. She just advises me, just like a good parent should.
Tabone usually spends her summers in Nome working, both in fisheries research and in subsistence activities with her family, fishing and picking greens and berries. However, this year, Tabone will be traveling throughout North America, attending powwows and a number of speaking events. Marjorie Tabone not only won the Miss Indian World crown, but also the Best Traditional Presentation, which was like a talent competition. For her talent, she demonstrated some native games, the one-foot high kick and the one-arm reach. Tabone will graduate with an Alaska Native Studies degree with a minor in Inupiaq. She plans on continuing to a master's program upon graduation. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a victory for homeless advocates in Anchorage.
We hope, having addressed the constitutional issues, that the municipality can now go forward and deal with the social issues. And we are hopeful that we can work with the municipality on that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
An ice jam on the Tanana River is causing flooding in an area of Salcha. Fairbanks North Star Borough spokeswoman Sally Stuvik says water is affecting four homes so far, but several other areas are threatened. Stuvik says the borough is coordinating a response with Salcha Rescue.
We did do a reverse 911 call last evening to the residents in that area just to let them know that the flood advisory had been issued, and it was pretty evident that the water was backing up fairly quickly. And then, of course, we'll be working on, making sure that the residents have sandbags and that type of stuff available to them, provided that, the situation worsens.
A stretch of the old Richardson Highway has been closed due to high water. The area of Salcha along Pile Driver Slough is prone to ice jam flooding, and Stuvik says property owners are experienced in how to handle it. There has not been an evacuation order so far, but National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum, who checked out the situation this morning, says there's concerns things could worsen.
If we do get another slug of ice running down the river, which there is some ice just upriver, that could push the water right over the top of the bank and cause more severe flooding.
Plum says the ice on the Salcha River, which flows into the Tanana upstream of the community, is going out, and that could pile up on the ice jam. He estimates the jam to be a quarter to a half mile long. Months of legal battling between the municipality of Anchorage and the Alaska Office of the American Civil Liberties Union has come to an end. Last week, the Anchorage Assembly unanimously approved an illegal campsite seizure ordinance acceptable to the ACLU and, more importantly, the courts. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The official resolution took less than 4 minutes of the Anchorage Assembly's regular session. It concluded a legal disagreement that began last April, when the ACLU filed a suit saying the city's new ordinance directed against illegal campsites was unconstitutional. The suit stemmed from the experience of camper Dale Engel. After the city seized and then destroyed his personal belongings, including documentation of his military service and honorable discharge, the ACLU said the municipality had not given sufficient time of the seizure possibility, nor did the city protect, in other words, store, his property once it had taken it. The court agreed with the ACLU, and when the city tried another ordinance with a slightly longer notice but still no protection of property, the ACLU continued its suit and won again. Before this week's assembly vote, ACLU attorney Jeffrey Mittman said the new version removed his organization's concerns.
We've reviewed it, and I want to say it's really very careful, it's complete, it really addresses the issue in its entirety, and we hope, having addressed the constitutional issues, that the municipality can now go forward and deal with the social issues, and we are hopeful that we can work with the municipality on that.
Under the ordinance, the municipality can give 3 days' notice before removing a campsite and taking the property. but it would then be stored for 30 days. Or they can give 15 days notice and immediately destroy any property seized. The Assembly has also approved $250,000 to renovate a warehouse for storage of campers' property. Besides Mittman, two others spoke at the public hearing. Ronald Jordan with the Taku Community Council said a full-scale campaign threatening to seize campers' personal belongings was likely to produce little more than migrations from neighborhood to neighborhood.
The people could pick up and move a quarter mile down the trail and start all over again. I'm concerned about the city resources in this, how it's handled, how the whatever rehab is available to these people as they proceed on. There is no silver bullet answer to this, but this is not the end-all answer for an abatement problem.
Assemblymember Pat Flynn represents downtown and adjacent neighborhoods. It's a district where several such camps have long existed. He responded to Jordan by saying he's aware that this ordinance is only a partial response to the problem of the homeless suffering from chronic inebriation and substance abuse.
I volunteer with the United Way to raise money to address some of the very issues that have been identified. And when we go to Juneau, we advocate for funding for programs that can help people get sober, get training, become productive members of society again. All those efforts need to be continued and redoubled, in fact, as we move forward to this. I think the legislation is very good. I just wish it hadn't cost us $90,000 to get it. Urge approval.
The illegal campsite and seizure ordinance takes effect immediately. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A survey team from the Bureau of Land Management will be in Sitka this summer to plat 11 acres of land selected by regional native corporation Sea Alaska 36 years ago. The property is Redoubt Lake Falls, one of Sitka's most heavily used subsistence fisheries. The possible transfer of public land into corporate hands has a local conservation group and the U.S. Forest Service concerned. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Redoubt Falls is the link between the Pacific Ocean and Redoubt Lake, and every year Sitkans fish for the sockeye salmon returning there to spawn. The falls also are home to a Forest Service fish weir, where workers keep track of the number of salmon climbing into the lake. Sea Alaska Corporation has selected 11 acres around the falls. The regional native corporation is entitled to select land under the terms of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and it made this selection in 1975. But the issue came back into public view recently with news that federal survey crews will visit the site this summer to move the conveyance of the land forward. Andrew Tomes is executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society. He says his organization objects to the land being privatized.
This is a huge deal. Redoubt Lake is one of the most important resources on the Tongass for Sitkans. This is where families go to catch their sockeye and fill their freezer. And to take such a critical place and move it from public ownership to private ownership sets a huge precedent and would be terrible for the community.
I really think those kind of statements don't acknowledge what we really are.
Sea Alaska Vice President and General Counsel Jaylena Rougeau.
We were a vehicle that Congress created to secure native ownership of native land. And to manage that land for the benefit of our native shareholders. There's a lot of preconceived notions about, you know, what would happen, and I think there's also just an assumption of the worst. And I really think people should talk to us and should understand that the BLM process really does protect pre-existing uses and rights, and also that we don't have control of the waterways even if we get the lands conveyed to us.
The 11 acres Sea Alaska has selected are around the falls that connect Redoubt Lake to Redoubt Bay. Arujo says the land was a seasonal village for the Kiksati clan of Tlingits. The site also has Russian history. As for subsistence fishing, Arujo says Sea Alaska can only select land, not waterways, and that people who fish there will still have access. Tomes, with the Conservation Society, points out that dip netters stand on the land, or at least tie up their boats, in order to catch sockeye. Still, Arujo says Sea Alaska has selected other sites already and maintained public access to them.
We generally take it on a case-by-case basis, and because of the important use as a subsistence area, we, of course, recognize the importance of subsistence uses in our communities. both for our shareholders and for those who live in those communities.
But beyond access concerns, Tomes says he also has environmental concerns.
If you control the readout falls and you own that, you pretty much own the whole watershed, because that's the core point for fish passage and for fishing.
The Forest Service has maintained a fish weir at the site continuously since 1982. Forest Service spokesman Ray Massey says his agency opposes the selection and has registered its objections with the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. The Bureau is responsible for the federal land transfers. Federal land selections can move very slowly. Gerald Ford was president when Sea Alaska made this selection, and the Forest Service submitted its comments 6 years ago. The BLM's deputy state director for lands in Anchorage says it's not known why the process has taken so long. But if the land transfer moves forward, Massey says the Forest Service would at least like to continue its operations at Readout.
We want, like, easements over there for the public to use it. We'd like easements for our people to go over to continue the weir, and, you know, and easements for the weir itself. So that's the latest we're on record with BLM as far as, you know, what our likes and dislikes are.
Federal land surveys are set to take place this summer, and at some point, although it's not yet clear when, the BLM says members of the public will have a chance to offer their feedback as well. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Fairbanks Assembly has passed a resolution allowing the borough to give ICE Alaska $1.7 million to help it buy land from the Alaska Railroad. The ICE Carving Group and the railroad have been unable to agree on a long-term lease or purchase deal for the 30-acre property where the World Ice Art Championships are held. Short of a new deal, ICE Alaska has to vacate the railroad land by June 30th. Speaking at last Thursday's Fairbanks North Star Assembly meeting, member Nadine Winters said, there's a contingency stipulation in the resolution giving money to ICE Alaska.
The intent of the assembly is that they reach a sales agreement, then this money is available for them for a grant.
The resolution sets a June 30th deadline for ICE Alaska to reach an agreement with the railroad. The railroad recently rejected a $4 million offer from ICE Alaska to buy the property, citing uncertain borough participation. The new resolution assures the $1.7 million borough portion is available. The Assembly passed a second resolution, which kicks in if ICE Alaska doesn't secure a purchase agreement. It would allow the group and other organizations to submit proposals for the funding to continue the ice carving event at another site. The Tanana Valley Fair Association and North Pole's Christmas in Ice have expressed interest in taking over the Ice Art Championships. North Pole Mayor Doug Isaacson said the local volunteers who put on the annual Christmas ice sculpture display are already preparing in case they get a chance to host the larger February-March event.
No matter what happens, even though July 1 might be a little bit late if someone wanted to plan for 2012, we're already in the planning stage as a backup. So the event will not disappear.
Isaacson said dozens of large ice blocks have been stockpiled in North Pole. He says volunteers can pull off the event, but the borough money is important for buildings and land. The high cost of energy and what to do about it was on the minds of many of the 1,300 members of Golden Valley Electric Association who packed the Carlson Center in Fairbanks last week for the co-op's annual meeting. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, wind power was a hot topic.
All the buzz stems from the GVEA board's decision in February to move ahead on the utility's Ava Creek Wind Project and to forego two other offers from the Delta Wind Farm and the proposed Fire Island Wind Project near Anchorage. Mike Kraft, the Fairbanks entrepreneur who's financed construction of the wind farm near Delta Junction, says he still thinks GVEA's board made the wrong choice. In an interview before the meeting, Kraft says he's decided against filing a complaint with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Instead, he says he'll leave it to GVEA members to make his case to the board. And he's considering using the 1 megawatt of electricity that the Delta Wind Farm is generating for other industrial facilities that he may build at the site.
You know, I really, to be honest with you, at this point, you know, I'd like to leave it up to the public. You know, if the public wants this, then we'll move forward with it. Bottom line is, we've got a nice project out there, and if nobody else wants to use the power, then I think we can probably put a factory out there and make ice or pump bottled water or... I'm going to do something with the power because it's too good a deal to pass up.
The board won't make a final decision on Ava Creek until its June meeting, but it appears unlikely to reverse its decision and to opt for other possibilities. GVEA President Brian Newton had to explain and defend the board's decision several times throughout the meeting, first during a slick PowerPoint-style presentation, and then later in response to a half dozen other inquiries during the members' comment portion of the meeting. Newton says Ava Creek will produce power for about 2.7 cents less per kilowatt hour than the Delta facility, and he says GVEA has thoroughly studied the Ava Creek site near Healy and concluded that GVEA will be able to integrate that facility's wind-generated electricity more readily than Delta's. Newton says GVEA is trying to incorporate more wind power into its system, but he says the best way to hold down electricity costs is to move ahead with a proposed natural gas trucking project and begin using that fuel to generate electricity, and to get the Healy Clean Coal Plant online. Using coal instead of wind doesn't sit well with Sean McGuire, another Fairbanks member who addressed the board and who suggested investing instead in wind.
Coal is the dirtiest fuel on the planet, and wind is the cleanest. And why not do all three of those wind projects?
Recycling entrepreneur Bernie Carl spoke in favor of both wind and coal and suggested that the board should quickly get about using more of both sources of energy to hold down electricity rates, or else.
Do I think we should have wind? Absolutely. Thank you, board, for voting on that. But it's even dumber that Healy Clean Coal isn't running. You know, come on. I say that Healy Clean Coal isn't running in 12 months. We vote the entire board out.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. The Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
And by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.